Welcome back to Title Talk. This is episode 3. I appreciate all of you guys who listened to episode 2 and episode 1. If you've listened to even a portion of it, we really appreciate it. We are glad that you are coming back to listen every week. We'll keep pushing this out to you every week as long as you guys enjoy it. We've got a packed episode for you today. We're going to discuss the Red Sox trade deadline, a little bit of Bruins talk about how they fare for the future, and much more. But before we do, as always, be sure to follow us on Instagram, Entering Title Town. We provide the best news, analysis, discussion that you will get in the Boston sports climate, especially with Patriots season coming up, Bruins season starting, Celtics season starting, possibly Red Sox playoffs. This is the perfect time to give us a follow and get your news curated to one account instead of having to follow four different accounts for four different sports. We've got it all in one. You'll hear the news from us first. You'll have the best community and discussion posts out there. We are posting for you guys. We are, you know, providing the news for you guys. And I can't think of any other accounts that do just that. So be sure to give us a follow. That's all I got for the intro. So let's get right into our first topic, and that is the Red Sox trade deadline. When we recorded episode 2, there was a little bit of confusion, a mystery around whether Heim was going to buy or sell, whether he was going to give the Sox a couple of bats, maybe a pitcher or two, and reload this lineup up that has suffered a lot of injuries, and really make a push for the playoffs and, you know, hopefully be able to compete with the likes of the Yankees and the Astros for a spot in the World Series. Or was he going to dump some of the contracts, some of the expiring deals, the likes of Christian Vasquez, Nathan Eovaldi, and JD Martinez, and recoup some talent and then try again next year, frankly, and punt the rest of the season? And he really did neither, and at the same time, he did both. There were a couple of sizable deals that went down, nothing too detrimental to the franchise or anything like that. There was a lot of talk about Bogart, Devers, were they going to get moved? Nothing like that happened, as you guys know. But there were some significant deals to discuss. And so I'm just going to go through and run through each deal that went down, and then we'll start from the top and go through each one and kind of what I think about it. So first deal, Christian Vasquez is traded minutes before the Red Sox play the Astros for two prospects, Emmanuel Valdez and Willie Abreu, if I'm saying that correctly, I'm not sure. So that was deal one. Deal two, Jake Diekman was sent away for catcher Reese McGuire. And then Tommy Pham was acquired from the Reds in exchange for a player to be named later. And then, quite frankly, the home run buy was Eric Hosmer being acquired along with Corey Rozier and Max Ferguson, two prospects for pitcher Jay Groom, with San Diego paying all of the salary of Eric Hosmer. That kind of ended the deadline and was the big buy of Heim's trade deadline. So why don't we just start right there? Eric Hosmer. There was some discussion about Eric Hosmer possibly joining the Red Sox earlier on in the offseason, before the CBA was agreed to, and before that December 1st deadline. There was a lot of talk about whether Hosmer was going to get moved. The Sox were looking for a first baseman. There wasn't too much out there in free agency. Hosmer was a name that got thrown around a lot. He hasn't taken that fall off that a lot of the older players do just yet, and he's still a serviceable guy with Gold Glove talent. And so he kind of was viewed as that perfect addition. But ultimately, nothing happened until, obviously, now at the deadline, he is acquired for Jay Groom, who is, quite frankly, nothing, and who I'm sure Heim wasn't too worried about sending off for a talent like Eric Hosmer. So the big part of this deal, in my opinion, is that the Padres are paying off the contract. The one gripe I had with Hosmer before was that he was making roughly, I think it was $44 million over the next four seasons or so. It was somewhere in the range of 11 to 13 mil average annual, and it was just ridiculous. Just for he is an older guy. He's probably not going to give you a 300 season ever again, and to fork out 10 plus million to him was certainly it would have been hard to do. But the Padres went ahead and paid off $44 million of his salary. They paid him down to the league minimum. Just to give you some perspective, in 2022, the Sox owe him just under $250,000 in 2023. In 2025, through those seasons, they owe him about $700,000 each season. So give or take, you're looking at about $2.5 million over the past, or over the next four seasons, compared to what would have been $44 million. So about a $40 million dollar discount for Heim. I don't see how anyone can call this deal a strikeout. The Red Sox have frankly been abysmal at first base with Bobby Dalbec and Franchi Cordero. Yeah, both of them have had hot streaks, but there hasn't been a solidified first baseman in a long time. You know, minus the addition of Kyle Schwarber last year, who kind of helped us out a little bit there. But Eric Hosmer is a perfect acquisition. You really give up nothing. He is a better bat than Bobby Dalbec, and he is a better bat than Franchi Cordero. So why not make the deal? You don't have to pay him anything over the next couple of years. He has an opt out in the offseason if he really wants to leave. But either way, if Heim is looking to replace and make some small jumps in talent this season for the rest of the year, this was a perfect move. And so to not give up anything and improve your lineup from the offensive side, and especially from the defensive side, where we've struggled as well, I don't know how you could say no to this. I'm sure Heim was thrilled when the Padres were willing to do this. Obviously, Hosmer was supposed to be in the Juan Soto deal, but he ended up having the Nationals on his no-trade list, and so the Padres kind of had to scramble. They wanted to free up some cap. A lot of people were asking, why would the Padres do this? What's the reasoning for it? Why would you pay off someone's salary just to trade him to another team? It's really confusing, and I don't even really understand it, but pretty much the Padres end up saving about $5 million towards the luxury tax threshold. It's not counted against them. $5 million isn't counted against them if they don't have the player on their roster. So under the new collective bargaining, it made sense for them to deal Hosmer away and then be able to save that $5 million. So that's the reason behind that. You can see from the Padres' perspective why they want to do it, clear as much cap as possible for other deals. And so it kind of made sense for both teams, and I'm certainly happy with the Hosmer deal, and I'm not really sure how you couldn't be pretty excited with this acquisition. The next trade, the next buy that I'll go over is Tommy Pham. There's not too much to say on him. He's having a pretty mediocre season, but again, if you're just looking at what Heim had to give up, what we got in return, I don't know how you could be mad at this. Similar to the Hosmer deal, and you know, even more so, Pham was acquired at a discount for a player to be named later. Those rarely become anything. Nothing from the MLB roster, nothing from the AAA roster is going to be dealt. No sizable prospects are going to be dealt in that deal. It was simply the Reds looking to dump a contract, dump a player, and not have to worry about him anymore. And Tommy Pham, like I said, hasn't had a great year, but the Sox have had a lot of holes in the outfield. Jaron Duran and JBJ are pretty much guaranteed outs at this point. You know, Duran had a little bit of a streak earlier on in the year, but frankly, he's all speed right now, and he needs to figure it out and get his back going. But Jackie Bradley Jr., who's no longer with the team, obviously, he is, you know, he hadn't performed well either in the early part of the season. So outfield was certainly a cause for concern. It was an area that I'm sure Heim was looking at from all different angles. And when you have, when you're presented with a player like Tommy Pham, who hasn't had the greatest year, but certainly has a strong bat, I think you have to make that deal, especially for, you know, the discount, the return that the Reds were asking for was literally nothing. And when you're in that position, the Sox are in, behind a couple of games in the wild card, really in that weird position where you could sell and you could buy at the same time, try to walk the line as best you can. Don't give up anything too valuable. Don't buy too heavily. Get what, you know, take what's given to you. And I think both the Hosmer deal and both the Tommy Pham deal both kind of fall into that category. So those are the two main buys of the deadline. The biggest sell, which kind of kicked off the deadline and it made a lot of people think that the Sox were going to obliterate this team and send JD and Eovaldi and possibly the likes of Bogarts. It was really interesting to see the reaction that people had when Christian Vasquez was moved to the Astros for Emmanuel Valdez and Willier Abreu, two prospects for the Astros. It happened minutes before the game between the Sox and the Astros was supposed to happen, so it was interesting to see the reaction. There's a lot of video of Vasquez kind of being surprised bit sad because, you know, he's been with the team for so long. But I think this is a perfect example of Heim being Heim. And a lot of the time, what he did with the Rays and what he has done in the past is capitalizing on trade value. And I think at this point, with where Christian Vasquez is, you know, in terms of where he ranks in the catching department in the MLB, he's near the top right now. He had an all-star caliber first half. And quite frankly, a team like the Astros, who is looking to add every piece possible to push their team into the playoffs, will overpay for Christian Vasquez. And getting two prospects that are ranked fairly highly in their department, in their prospect department, you know, I think it's just that you couldn't really say no. And I think especially with the prospect of Vasquez potentially leaving the team in the offseason because his deal does expire, it just made sense for Heim to make this deal. Look, would I rather have Christian Vasquez on the team in a playoff run? Sure. If we make it to the playoffs as the 3 wild card and, you know, we end up losing by a run in a wild card game or the wild card series, I believe it is now, it's certainly going to be a stinger because you're going to wish that Vasquez was in that lineup, of course, without a doubt. But at this point, where the Sox are, where the Sox have, you know, placed themselves due to their poor play, you know, I think that Heim knows that you have to capitalize on any value that gets thrown at you at the deadline. Vasquez will never return what he did ever again. And so, frankly, I'm not mad about the deal. I think I would have probably questioned it a little bit more than Heim did, or tried to squeak out a little bit more. But I think at this point, you know, the Sox have put themselves in this position, and I'm glad we didn't full sell, full, you know, just yard sale, get everyone out of here. But if there was one of those players that I thought would return the most value at this moment, it's certainly Christian Vasquez. And who knows, there may have been internal talks with Vasquez that he wasn't going to return to the team. And if you're, you know, not going to pay your catcher in the offseason, you might as well try to get as much as you can for him. And that's really what happened in this deal. And, you know, it sucks because he's a household name. Like I mentioned earlier, he's been with the team since like 09 or something like that. A long time in the prospect pool, whatever you want to call it, the system, the farm system. That's what I was looking for. But you know, it is what it is. It is a business at the end of the day, and Heim got a good return. And no matter what you want to say, Emmanuel Valdez has already popped off in AAA. He's already been placed in AAA. You might even see him later on in the season as, the rosters expand in September. We'll certainly have to see, but you know, you got to wait with the prospect return. You're not exactly sure what you're going to get from them, and it's more of a wait and see. But it was certainly a capitalization on value, without a doubt. And I don't know how you can be mad at Heim for doing that. Those were the three main trades. The Reese McGuire trade was a little bit, you know, like I said, a little bit weird. Diekman is traded for Reese McGuire in a 1-for-1. Diekman is set to get paid this year, next year, $8 million total for a year. You are able to free up $4 million in cap. You don't have to pay him next year. He's been pretty bad all year. I don't really get why the White Sox did it. I'm sure they're just looking for an extra arm for their playoff push. And maybe Reese McGuire hasn't really been anything for them. I don't know too much on him, but to be honest, I don't really mind it just because Diekman has almost been a negative to this team thus far in the league and in the year, and I don't want to have to pay him next year. And frankly, if you can dump him off for nothing, I would do that in a second. And you got a catcher for him who seems to be a platoon guy for the rest of the year, so it's kind of a mad deal. It doesn't really matter. There's not much analysis you really have to do on it. And, you know, that's really all I have to say on that. So those are the trades overall. It was a meh to good trade deadline, in my opinion. I think there's no way you can take only negatives out of this, but there are certainly some negatives you can take. But before we do that, let's look over the positives, which I think there are a lot, and I think people are ignoring. We added two potentially great bats to the lineup, Eric Hosmer, Tommy Pham. They're both upgrades. If I would rather have Tommy Pham in the lineup over Jackie Bradley Jr. I would rather have Eric Hosmer in the lineup over Franchy Cordero or Bobby Dalbec. When you do that, when you're trying to make a push for the playoffs, when you can upgrade where you can, when you can take the negative bats out of the lineup and replace them with new, potentially good bats, you got to do it. The return that each team got for Hosmer and Pham was little to nothing. You can't be mad at those deals. You added two great bats, and especially Hosmer, I think he'll perform great at Fenway. And so that's certainly a positive. You added two new bats, which is what everyone wanted. You retooled the prospect pool for future deals. You added, theoretically, if you want to count the prospects that we got in the Eric Hosmer deal as well, you added four new prospects combined between the Vasquez deal and the Hosmer deal. And those four new prospects, you know, maybe they aren't a lot, but if they can give you some type of value in the future for a big trade, if it's, they're a throw-in, if they're, you know, if two of them can, you know, tip the tables to get, you know, a big name, you're going to look back and say, I'm glad we made that trade. So always retooling that prospect pool, recouping what you can in value, adding new names to the farm system. You never know what someone can turn out to be. We've seen situations where, sellers at the deadline get a prospect back who no one knows about, and it turns out to be Fernando Tatis or whatever it may be. That can happen, and I think Haim did a great job with getting four prospects for what he could give up and what he, I'm sure, didn't want to, but wanted to capitalize on the value. That's the main objective for a GM, and without a doubt, he did a great job at that at the deadline. And one last thing is that Haim really didn't throw in the towel. I think that's a positive. He didn't just punt the season. He wanted to walk the line. He probably understands both sides of the seller and the buyer argument. And I think he did a perfect job walking that line. Sure, you can make critiques about him selling Vasquez. And, you know, that's kind of the, one of the first negatives I wanted to talk about. But he didn't throw in the towel. He certainly believes in this team to an extent. And there's enough talent to push this team into the playoffs, which is really what you, all you can ask for, post deadline. So the first negative, like I said, you lost your starting catcher. That kind of speaks for itself. Gravasquez is, you know, he's been great offensively. He's good defensively. He's got a lot of good relationships with the pitchers. You're going to have to mend that. And it certainly upset a lot of people in the locker room, as we heard from Bogaerts. But, you know, that's frankly a pretty black and white negative. It stinks. You know, you wish you still had your starting catcher in a playoff run, without a doubt. And alluding to that, you might have possible locker room issues because of it. If you upset players because you traded your starting catcher, you know, that can be cause for concern for future deals, future contracts, and just chemistry overall. And it's certainly not something you want to have to deal with when you're just three games out of a wild card spot. And then the last big one, the biggest one, is frankly that you've held on to a lot of potential value. JD Martinez, Nathan Eovaldi, both expected to leave in the offseason. Now you're going to get nothing for them. And unless you are able to get those guys back on some team-friendly deals, frankly, that is a big loss when you lose a guy like Martinez and a guy like Nathan Eovaldi for nothing, when you certainly could have gotten a lot for either one. Now, if you make the playoffs, that, you know, that scenario switches. Now you've kept JD and Nathan Eovaldi for your playoff run, and the success you have in there should be certainly acknowledged by Haim's hesitation to move those two. However, if you don't make the playoffs, Haim will have to answer to, why didn't you trade JD Martinez and why didn't you trade Nathan Eovaldi when you dumped Christian Vasquez and made the team you know, lose its starting catcher? That'll certainly have to be a question that Haim answers, but again, we're not in that situation yet. The Sox are in a position to make the playoffs. They're only, I believe, three and a half out, somewhere in that range. You've got a ton of games left. The team has played well in the past, and this is not one of those middling teams that has not played well. The potential of this team has been shown. You added two new bats. You subtracted one great bat. You know, you can decide whether that's a good move or not, but either way, this team has the talent, has the motivation, hopefully now, to push for the playoffs. And I don't think Haim royally messed the franchise up at this deadline, like some are alluding to. I think he did a pretty good job walking the line. And I have to say, it's a pretty B deadline. It was very, you know, it was a very average deadline. He didn't mess too many things up, which is all you can ask for. And he also didn't, you know, add too many additions that are notable, I guess you could say. So that's all I got for the Red Sox deadline. Obviously, we'll be keeping track of them all season, all rest of the season, to see if they can push their way into the playoffs. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll be back with some Patriots discussion about how training camp has gone not so good for the offensive side. So stay tuned. We're now about a week and a half into Patriots training camp, and you're able to kind of establish some takeaways from camp at this point. You know, maybe it was a little early, a day, 2 days in, 3 days in, whatever. But when you get this far in, you can kind of see the patterns that have been occurring every day. And one pattern that has unfortunately been occurring is that the offense has been in shambles for the start of camp. Greg Bedard reporting that it's among the worst he's seen covering the league, referring to the Patriots offense. If you look at the Patriots offense on the surface, you'd like to think that they've really only added, citing Devontae Parker as that addition, they haven't really lost much, and you wouldn't expect them to take any steps back when it comes to offensive performance. But it seems pretty clear that at least on 11-on-11s, when it really comes down to the fundamentals of the game, Mac Jones in the team and the offensive side are struggling a lot. So now you kind of have to dig a little bit deeper. There's nothing on the offense on the field that's changed, but on the sidelines, a major change occurred over the offseason. Obviously, Josh McDaniels is no longer with the squad, and no one really knew how much of an impact he was going to, how much his absence was going to affect the team. But it seems like now we know, and he was touted as this perfect fit for Mac Jones. He performed so well with Tom Brady. A lot of people, you know, a lot of Brady haters will even go on to say McDaniels was the reason why Brady was so successful. He knew his game style. He knew his play style. He knew what he was, his strengths and weaknesses. Now, you may argue that's kind of what an offensive coordinator should do. But no matter what, they were so compatible with each other. And when Mac Jones came in, everyone thought, look, Mac mimics Brady so much. And so it only makes sense that McDaniels is going to work well with Mac Jones when it comes around, when time comes and week one hits last season. It looked like they were, you know, doing great. Mac Jones makes the playoffs in his first season. Obviously, it didn't work out too well, but the fact that they were able to even make the playoffs is certainly a testament to Belichick and McDaniels being able to coach a rookie quarterback to the playoffs for the first time. And so I don't think people really knew when he left if he was going to affect Mac's growth, affect Mac's confidence too much. And it seems like these camp performances that we're seeing are kind of the repercussions from that. And, you know, it's not just that McDaniels left and that Mac maybe isn't exactly sure how to handle it or how to go about changing his style up because he's missing his offensive coordinator. But it's also that the Patriots simply didn't fill the role, and there doesn't seem to be clear and concise coaching from anyone on the offensive side. And when you have a rookie quarterback, who's now in his sophomore year, but just his second year in the league, you need clear, concise coaching. You need clear, concise offense. You need it to be simplified. You need it to be straightforward. And frankly, you need it to be consistent. And so when you switch the offense up by taking Mac Jones' offensive coordinator away from him after one successful season, you knew there was going to be struggles. But unfortunately, Belichick made it even worse by not replacing him, there were many options out there, certainly. And he decided to kind of sit in the middle, not really give a straight answer, kind of throw different bodies in there, Joe Judge, Matt Patricia, even himself, to try to coach the offense, and it seems like none of it's working. And so that's definitely a panic button press for me when you see your offense struggling this much in camp. You know, yeah, it's not the preseason yet. It's not, you know, week one. You know, we haven't seen Mac Jones in his element. However, when they can't even make a complete pass, when they can't even get a run up the middle for 2 yards, you know, what makes you think they're going to be able to deal with the Buffalo D-line or, you know, the Dolphins defense or whatever it may be to compete in the division? And so there seems to be an issue there. And I think it all stems from coaching. I don't think Mac Jones took a step back or anything like that. I think, frankly, they've just done a poor job of placing coaching around him to give him the best shot at competing. And additionally, you know, the defense does have to get some credit. I think there's been a number of reports that they have performed really well. And, you know, whether that's based on how bad the offense has performed, I don't know. But it seems like a lot of the guys that we are hoping are going to take a jump this year are going to. Jalen Mills was cited as possibly being the cornerback one on the team. People are kind of ant about that, but you know, I think it's a good thing, the fact that, you know, people are saying that and the fact that his talent reflects that. Devon Gashaw just got a new contract. He's been great in the trenches. Christian Barmore seems to be having a great camp. So there's a lot of defensive pieces that also might be making the offense look a little bit worse than it actually is. The Patriots, I think, are going to have a decent defense. Now, it's not going to be good as last year, I don't think, with the loss of J.C. Jackson and a couple other guys. But that does have to be noted when you're talking about the offense. They do have to go up against a defense. And so when you're, you know, picking out why the offense hasn't performed as well, I do think a look at the defense, a look on the opposite side of the field has to be noted. But in general, it is worrying to see the offense struggle as much as it had. It is worrying to see these experts like Greg Bedard, who have been around for so long, say he's never seen a worse offensive scheme, offensive output in the league, in his time in the league. We'll have to see. The only thing that's going to tell us where this goes is time. But unfortunately, it's not what you want to hear just a week and a half into camp. So we brought a lot of negatives in that first segment. Unfortunately, you may come away from that segment thinking that the Patriots are in huge trouble with their offense. But I've got a bit of a more positive report for you. A lot of different outlets are claiming that Mac Jones and Devontae Parker have a great connection thus far, a connection that we haven't seen him have with a receiver thus far in his short career, and it seems like he's being targeted a lot and that there is a lot of chemistry being formed. There's a ton of different videos of you know, Parker catching touchdowns and just passes in general from Mac, and it looks like they're both forming some type of relationship, which is great to see. Parker has been kind of an up-and-down receiver. You guys probably know, you know, he was last with the Dolphins. In 2019 really was his last big year that he's had. He went for 1,200-plus yards. He had 9 touchdowns. He's certainly a talented receiver, without a doubt. I don't think that's ever been questioned. The only thing that people had concern for was his injuries. He is fairly injury-prone. And also, he really hasn't had the greatest quarterback play in his career. He had, you know, Tua last season, and he had, I believe it was Fitzpatrick the years before that. And he may have had one more quarterback, but I can't think of who it would be. No matter what, if I can't think of who it is, obviously he's not too notable. So that was really the biggest thing with Parker, was his injuries, and that he really hasn't had a true quarterback throwing to him. If Mac Jones can be that true quarterback, I think we may see a return of 2019 Devontae Parker, which would certainly boost the Patriots' offensive capabilities this season. And I think it was what the offense was missing last season. You had Jacoby Myers, who was coming in as a rookie. You had Kendrick Bourne, who had been around the league but had never really established himself as that true number one receiver, and I don't think necessarily ever will. I think he has the talent, but can he be the go-to guy? I'm not sure. He hasn't shown it yet. So you weren't expecting too much from him. Really, the guys you were expecting the offense from last year were Hunter Henry and Jonnu Smith. And although Hunter Henry was a touchdown machine at portions of the season, Jonnu Smith really didn't turn out to be anything. Well, hopefully those two can come back and make up for their losses. But there's no doubt that we were missing something last season. And was it the ability for Mac to find a go-to receiver, a go-to wideout, instead of just two tight ends that he didn't seem to have too much chemistry with? That might be the missing piece. And I think Parker has the history of being the go-to guy. As we've talked about before, even in the seasons where he hasn't had too much talent around him, including at the quarterback position, he's been able to perform. And when he's gotten that chance, when he's gotten that target share that we're seeing early on in camp, he's certainly performed at a high level. And I think he's one of the more underrated receivers in the league. I think any sort of talent that gets brought into this Patriots offense is welcomed. And, what we were hoping early on in training camp was to see that Mac Jones was forming that connection with Devontae Parker. And it's certainly welcoming to see what type of talent the Patriots may have acquired for just what a third round pick. So that's, you know, again, camp has to continue to move on before we really make a you know, determination on whether Devontae Parker can be that guy. You know, he's gonna see probably the cornerback ones when we face, you know, the likes of the Ravens, and teams like that. So he's gonna have to, you know, play up to the talent. Will he be able to? I'm not sure. But the only thing that you could take thus far is that Mac Jones feels that he is that talented receiver that he's been missing, that wide receiver one that he's been missing, and that is very welcomed in Mac Jones' second season, with the Patriots. We didn't have any discussion about the Bruins last episode. Episode one, we touched briefly on them, just regarding, you know, Bergeron's possible return, Krejci's possible return as well. But for episode three, I wanted to dive a little bit deeper into what the future looks like for the Bruins. They're kind of in this weird spot where they've got a lot of talent that's going to be expiring in the next couple of years. Bergeron probably only has 1 year left, Marchand a couple. And that's two of your key pieces that you've had on this team for the past decade plus. And that's always, you know, a tough franchise decision to read at this point about what they're going to do and what type of, you know, position they're going to be in a couple of seasons. So I wanted to look at that and kind of analyze what the Bruins could look like down the road. First of all, let me just, you know, start off by saying a lot of this kind of falls onto Bergeron and whether he decides to come back or not. So I'm going to go ahead and kind of skip over this season because if he comes back, the Bruins are going to be a competitive team. If he doesn't come back, the Bruins are not going to be a competitive team. So that I'm not really counting this year because Sweeney doesn't have a replacement for Bergeron, nor could he really get one with his decision kind of looming. So I'm going to kind of just skip over this year and just look at every other year down the road for the next, you know, 5 or 6 seasons, just to see what type of team this is, you know, what type of team is going to be fielded after Bergeron decides to call it quits. So first of all, in the National Hockey League, you really need to check three boxes, at least two boxes. You need to check at least two boxes to be a competitive team. And those three boxes are a top forward, a top defenseman, and an established goalie. You really have to have two out of three of those to be a competitive team in the league. You rarely see a bunch of misfits coming together and winning a cup, other than maybe you want to point to the 2019 St. Louis Blues that beat us. There really is a pretty standard procedure with who wins the cup and who competes at a high level. And so when you look at the Bruins roster and you look at guys under 30, which is kind of what I'm going to gauge this as, anyone under 30, I would consider a future piece to this team. They do check at least two of the boxes, and I would even say they check off the third. So first of all, David Pastrnak, he is your top forward. He will be your top forward. I'm pretty confident that he will be extended by Sweeney even before the season starts. I think he'll get somewhere around 8, 9 years at, I don't know, 9 to 10 average annual. You know, that doesn't really matter. As long as we can lock him up for the next 8 to 9 years, I'm happy with it. He's your top forward. He's your top goal scorer. He's one of the best goal scorers in the league. You know, that's obvious. You've checked that box. Charlie McAvoy has established himself as, quite frankly, I think the best defenseman in the league. Maybe that's a little bit of Boston bias, but I don't think anyone is able to show so much on the defensive and the offensive end at the same time. Rarely you see defensemen play at the top of each side, and I think McAvoy does that better than anyone in the league. So you've got the defenseman portion checked off, and you've got him locked up for, I believe it's another 7 or 8 years. He was just extended recently. And then you've got the goaltending. So obviously Tuukka Rask retiring, that hurts. You have to find another established goalie. No matter what your opinion on Tuukka Rask is or was, he was a veteran goalie that gave this team a chance to win on any given night, especially in the playoffs. And so you have to find someone to replace him. It's not going to be easy. But Jeremy Swayman, who is, I believe he's under the age of 20. Yeah, he's definitely under the age of 25. I'm not sure his exact age, but he's a young guy. He just finished his rookie season. He looked great in his rookie year. he is looking like he may be the future of the goaltending in Boston. And even if you don't want to say that he's an experienced, established goalie just yet, I think he's well on his way there. So even, you want to give them half a check there. They get 2.5 out of 3 checks for competitive to be competitive in the league. I think that that is a fantastic start if you're looking at the future of a team. The next thing you have to look at is the supplements around those players. A lot of the time, you might see teams get into cap trouble and pay their players far too much money and not be able to provide them depth scoring. You saw kind of sh saw it with the Blackhawks. Jonathan Taves and Patrick Kane have a ton of cap tied up between them, and they're having to start dumping guys off because they simply can't field a great team around those two because there is way too much cap tied within a couple of guys. So that's one thing you want to look at. You don't want too much. Hockey's not a sport where you can pay one guy half the salary or half your salary cap and be able to compete. You really need to spread the wealth pretty well. And if you're just looking at the supplements for the Bruins that are under the age of 30, you're talking about Hampus Lindholm, who was just extended, acquired at the trade deadline. He is going to be Charlie McAvoy's partner in crime for a number of the next couple of years at least. Jake DeBrusk, who was just extended, yes, he wanted to get traded halfway through the year. Bruce Cassidy gets fired. He rescinds his trade offer. It looks like that was the reason why he didn't really like Bruce Cassidy. So you can expect him to be with the team for the next 2 seasons. And Brandon Carlo, who's just entering his prime, he's had a ton of criticism. His extension that was signed was, a decent amount of money. And I think people kind of looked at that and felt like he wasn't necessarily playing up to his potential. But people forget he was pretty young. He's kind of entering his prime right now. The next couple of seasons are going to show whether he is, that defenseman that we want him to be, that top four, a guy that we expect him to be. But either way, if you're just looking at supplemental pieces on the blue line, Brandon Carlo is a great third defenseman to have. Even if you want to consider him as a fourth behind Matt Grizzlick, your top four defensemen are pretty locked in for the next 3, 4, 5 seasons, which is not what many teams can say in the league. And then on the DeBrusk side, on the forward side, I think DeBrusk has shown in the past that he can be a first line winger, and we saw how he performed with Bergeron and Marchand when he got put up on that top line. I think you might see that again this year with Pasternak down with Taylor Hall and hopefully David Krejci. I think giving DeBrusk a full season on that first line would do wonders for him. I think he's a future piece of this team without a doubt, and he's certainly going to help lessen the blow of a Brad Marchand retirement or Brad Marchand regression when it comes time for that. So we've just looked at the supplemental pieces. They've got two established defensemen without a doubt, with Hampus Lindholm and Brandon Carlo to aid Charlie McAvoy, and they've got Jake DeBrusk, who hopefully will provide some scoring and some cushion in that forward category when the older guys decide to call it quits. And then what you want to do is you want to look in the pipeline a little bit deeper, the prospect pipeline. You want to see what type of players in 3 or 4 seasons will be coming into that, age 24, 25 to bring in another 5 or 6 years of solid play. And this is where the Bruins struggle a little bit. They've had really bad drafts over the years. The notable one is, I believe, 2015. They had 3 first-round picks in a row, and it was, I believe, Zach Senyshyn, Brandon Carlo, and Jakub Zboril. Obviously, Brandon Carlo has turned out to be pretty good, but other than that, Zach Senyshyn, I don't believe, is on the team anymore, even in the pipeline, and Zboril has dealt with injuries and has not been what a lot of people thought he was going to be. So those were huge misses that really hurt the team, and overall, they just have not picked very well in the past. But two guys that are of note, Mason Leroy and Fabian Lassell, both guys look like they're going to be able to establish themselves at a professional level. Mason Leroy, I believe, is headed back to Ohio State for this next season, while Fabian Lassell actually might be competing for a roster spot this year. Either way, I think you'll see him in Providence. And both of them are fantastic scorers, and I think That's what you really look for at the young age. If they can establish themselves in the minors as top end scorers that can provide a ton of offense, I think you'll see that transition pretty well to the professional NHL level. But either way, they're highly ranked in a lot of analysis prospect rankings. It's not just Boston fans nitpicking and looking for someone to have confidence in for the future. These guys are actually pretty established in the NHL prospect rankings, and I think they'll give a little bit more cushion in the forward department, which is kind of where you want if you're looking at the team's weaknesses down the road. We don't have too many forwards at the NHL level right now that are going to be able to replace Patrice Bergeron and Brad Marchand. And so when you look down the pipeline, you'd like to see a couple of guys like that. And Mason Leroy and Fabien Lassell are those two guys. So you've kind of looked at the roster as a whole, up and down. Just a quick look. Obviously, we can't dive too deep into it, but you got a couple of prospects. You got supplemental pieces. You've got the two established top-end guys in David Pastrnak and Charlie McAvoy. And you've got the up-and-coming goalie in Jeremy Swayman. So thus far, the Bruins look at least in a very decent spot, if you want to put it that way. The next part you want to look at is whether they have a lot of cap trouble in the near future. And right now the Bruins are locked up in some bad contracts. And, you know, you can start wherever you like. There are a number of forwards and there are a number of defensemen that I think I would rather not have on the team right now based on their cap total. However, they're not signed to long-term deals, and they're all off the books in the next couple of seasons. So number one, Nick Foligno, he's getting 3.8 this season. He's off the books next year. You won't see him back. That's nearly $4 million freed up in just one player who's probably going to see the fourth line this year if he sees any time at all. Craig Smith, he's been a pretty decent piece to this offense in the past. However, I don't think he's going to come back at his cap number. He's at 3.1 this season. He also expires next year. Even if you wanted to bring him back, I think you would be able to take a little bit of a discount on him at maybe a 2.5 for, you know, the next three or so seasons if he really wants to come back. But either way, let's say you want to free him up. Between him and Foligno, that's about $7 million freed up in just two players that you can use to, possibly go out and get some new talent. And then on the blue line, Derek Forbert, Mike Riley, both making $3 million a year this season. They're on the books until 2024, unfortunately. But again, when you're looking at the future of a team, you're not really looking at their cap troubles 2 years down the road. You're looking at their cap troubles 4 or 5 years down the road. And all of these guys that we kind of deem as like bad deals are all out of the team in the next couple of seasons if Sweeney deems that necessary. So really looking at the cap troubles for the Bruins, they don't have too many. Yes, in the immediate future, they don't have too much cap to spend. But all these deals are also expendable. You don't have any $6 or $7 million deals to a 35-year-old that no one's going to want. All these guys could provide some value to playoff teams if, this season, if Bergeron doesn't come back and you kind of want to punt it, you can make these guys, tradable at the deadline and get some, even recoup some value instead of having them just leave the team in free agency. So it seems like to me, the perception of the Bruins around the media, around the fan base in general, is that they're kind of half going to be doomed for years in a rebuild. And I just simply disagree. And I think me looking at each piece and me analyzing each piece like I just did kind of shows that they're not as much trouble as some kind of believe. Retooling, I think, is a better word for it because they have pieces to build around. You're not going to see them rebuild with David Pastrnak and Charlie McAvoy entering their prime. It's simply not going to happen. They've got the cornerstone pieces. They've got the supplemented talent, like we mentioned. They've got about $10 million off the books in the next 2 to 3 years. The number's closer to $12 million off the books in the next two seasons. They have a lot of team-friendly deals, just to make note of four of them. McAvoy is signed for another 7 years at 9.5. With the way the cap is going, with the way some of these deals have gone down this offseason, that's a fantastic discount for a top-end defenseman. Hampus Lindholm was just extended for 7 years at 6.5. So you've got him and McAvoy locked up for the next seven seasons. Lindholm at 6.5 is fantastic. He's not an old defenseman. He, again, I think can establish himself with McAvoy and become that top pairing. And again, with the way the cap has gone for the NHL, you have to pay guys early on and you have to give them what you think they'll be worth later on, and instead of waiting and extending him in a couple of years where the cap, where his 6.5 number may more look like 7.5, you're able to spread the wealth and spread him out over the next seven seasons. And I think it was a great deal for Sweeney, and I think Bruins fans should be happy about that. And then two on the forward department, Taylor Hall is on for another 3 years at $6 million. With his scoring ability and his offensive talent when he gets going, at $6 million, I mean, just looking at other deals around the league, I mean, you could have gotten hosed with a Hall deal, you know, that was upwards of $8 million. I think if he decided to leave Boston and last season and go into free agency, I think he could have got upwards of $7-7.5 million. But because he wanted to stay with Boston, because he wanted to stay for a cup, to try to compete for a cup, he takes a discount and you get him for $6 million, which is just a crazy number over the next three seasons, where he should be a really high contributor on the team. And then Brad Marchand, we've talked about him. You know, he is getting older. He's into his, I think he's 33 now. But for the next three seasons, he should continually be a top talent in the offensive category in the entire professional league. And he's at just a 6.1 cap hit for the next three seasons. So he's at pretty much the same cap as Taylor Hall, if that's imaginable. So you can see how well we got Marchand on a discount as well. So the really four big deals of established guys in this team are all fairly team friendly. And that's a fantastic baseline to have when you're looking at possibly having to supplement some significant talent in Patrice Bergeron when he decides to depart. One thing I will concede, the pipeline is dry. I don't think anyone can say it isn't. I believe we ranked 32 out of 32, or we were last place, I believe, in the pipeline rankings that was just done by some hockey database that kind of ranks, you know, how well prospects are in each franchise. And we did rank last, so there's no denying that we have some trouble there. But Lassell and Leroy, I think they're forwards where you may. They're both forwards, and that's kind of where you deem yourself as the weakest. And having two guys in the pipeline that have some notice around the league is certainly welcomed, and it's a great spot for the Bruins to be in. With how weak their pipeline is, I'd rather have them be very strong in the forward department than weak in the forward department. Obviously, we have enough defensemen, we have a goaltender, we need the forwards, and hopefully at least one of those guys can hit and become a key piece of the team in the future. And then lastly, the goaltending is in a great spot. Linus Ullmark has been a fairly good pickup. I think people kind of gaffed at the contract he got, but you know, with where we were at that point with Rask, you know, potentially coming back later on in the season. Obviously, he tried to and then wasn't able to. But you needed to have someone step in as a veteran presence and be able to provide some cushion in the goaltending department and not throw it all on Swayman. I think that was a great deal for us. And then Swayman looks like a gem at this point. He's a young guy out of UMaine. He's, you know, played really well in his rookie season. And when you're looking at the future of your goaltending, I like where it is in the hands of Ullmark and Swayman. Ullmark on a movable deal when Swayman decides to take over. Swayman likely going to get extended at some point to give this team even more cap flexibility and an established goalie at a very young age. So the Bruins have enough talent to maintain competitiveness, bottom line. They're really not missing too much after Bergeron leaves. Free agency, Boston's a very attractive place to come play. It's got a history. It's got a rabid fan base. I think players understand that. So free agency should also welcome a lot of new talent. I think there's a lot of interesting guys in the next couple of years that are going to be free agents. So I think you're going to see the Bruins stay in a competitive spot for the next 5-6 years when people think they're going to kind of fall off. And obviously only time will tell. I think we should worry a little bit. It's certainly not going to be as easy as we could have made it because of Sweeney's mess-ups in the draft and both in free agency. But I don't think we have to worry too much. I think this team is going to be in a much better spot come, you know, 2025, 2026, then people really like to put them in. So that's it for the Bruins segment. I know it was a bit of a longer one. Hope you guys stayed for the whole time. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to do a quick hit on the Celtics before we wrap things up for episode 3. So the KD saga has continued for the Boston Celtics. Last week, we talked about how Shams and Woj both kind of dropped that bomb on us. I believe it was like early last week, Monday morning, something like that. Pretty much said that KD was trying to be acquired by the Celtics. They offered a trade. Jaylen Brown was in the deal. Derek White was in the deal. And a draft pick was. The Nets declined, blah, blah, blah. Chaos ensues where Jaylen Brown's tweeting. A lot of reports saying Brown wants out. Another lot of counter reports saying he wants to stay. It was a complete mess. And so we won't spend too much time on this because we kind of already discussed it last episode. But one thing that did come out, one new development, was that there was a report, there's just reports in general, that the Nets may have tried to push this trade out, even deeming it a fake trade, to kind of increase KD's value. And the idea was that teams will see that the Celtics offered Jaylen Brown, and that they would have to offer more than that to be able to even have a chance at Kevin Durant. Now, it's tough to really decide which side you're going to be on in this case. I mean, certainly there is a chance that the Nets decided to fake this trade and put a false report out there. It's not out of the question, I don't think. The Nets are in, you know, what you would consider a scramble mode. They kind of have to deal Kevin Durant by the end of the offseason, just because he doesn't really want to be there. And I think Kevin Durant, with how his attitude is, when he doesn't want to be there, when he doesn't want to be somewhere, I think you have to get rid of him, you know, sooner rather than later. So they are in a scramble mode. I could see it happening. But I think the Celtics could have just as easily offered this trade, and the Nets beat writers, reporters decide to leak it anyway to do the same thing. I think that's a bit more believable. I think the Celtics did offer this trade, and I also think the Nets leaked it to up the value of Kevin Durant. I think that is the most likely scenario that's occurred, without a doubt. And I think more so the Celtics are attempting to kind of spin it on the Nets and say that we never offered that trade, and that Jaylen Brown is going to be a Celtic forever, and that he's not going to get traded, to kind of calm Jaylen Brown's nerves, and that they're kind of angry at the Nets for leaking it. I think that that's what happened, honestly. I don't really, you know, blame Brad Stevens for, you know, throwing that out there. If the trade would have went through, I think you would have had a lot of Celtics fans with the immediate emotional reaction that this is ridiculous. I can't believe we traded one of our young stars, you know, this and that. And I think I would have been on that boat as well. But I think after a little bit of time, you would have seen Kevin Durant and Jason Tatum becoming that tandem, one of the more unstoppable tandems we've seen in the past couple of seasons. And I think you would have had a lot of Celtics fans change their mind about how they felt about that trade. So I think Brad's kind of ahead of the curve on that. Now, the trade was declined. The trade isn't going to go through, obviously. And the Nets want a lot more for him, as we saw in their counteroffer that included, you know, Marcus Smart and multiple firsts and Jaylen Brown and a lot more than what the Celtics are willing to offer. But I certainly think this whole notion that the Nets fake the trade is just not true. I don't blame the Celtics for attempting to kind of spin the narrative and try to see if they can kind of blame it on the Nets for lying, because it's kind of a hard thing to prove. Otherwise, you can't really, you know, it's kind of he said, she said kind of thing, two sides saying different things. And it's tough to be able to deem who is actually on the truthful side. And so, you know, the best thing the Celtics can do at that point is just to try to flip it on the Nets and flip the blame on the Nets and, you know, not cause a complete catastrophe in Boston where Jaylen Brown thinks no one wants him here and now you have to trade him and now his trade value goes down and blah, blah, blah. So it's a tough scenario. I mean, it's kind of cooled down since we last discussed it, which is a good thing, obviously. But it'll be something to watch, at least for the next couple of months, to see how Jaylen Brown reacts. Once there's a little bit more publicity with it, I think right now Jalen Brown's kept a lot of things under wraps. I'd like to see what he has to say about it, whether he believes it, whether he's heard otherwise from Brad Stevens. We'll keep you guys updated on our Instagram and on the podcast, obviously, if anything starts to materialize. But as of now, it doesn't seem like anything is really going to happen in the immediate future. So that's it for episode 3 of Title Talk. I appreciate you all for joining me. Next week, we're hoping to get a co-host slash guest to help me out. It might be an interview with one of the segments. We'll figure that out, but definitely be on the lookout. We'll keep you updated on our Instagram page, so be sure to follow us, Entering Titletown. Join us next week for episode 4. Until then, thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next week. I think I'm going to Boston. I think I started a new life. I think I started early.